Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 8th of August. There is an increase in the number of police who are in our country's schools, and there is also an increase in the arrests of students for offenses like talking back to a police officer, doodling on a desk, or throwing a temper tantrum. We ask the question this hour, are we criminalizing childhood misbehavior? And why is it that the overwhelming number of arrests are Black or Latino students? We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour. Aaron Kupchick will be joining us in a moment, professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Delaware. And later, Annie Thomas is a senior in high school in Miami. She's with a group called Dream Defenders, and they are concerned about these arrests and also about Stand Your Ground. They've been conducting a sit-in in the Florida governor's office, now entering its fourth week, and they're hearing testimony from students all over Florida concerning the issues that we are talking about. We welcome your phone calls during the course of the hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, where you can always leave messages, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Aaron Kupchick is a professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Delaware, whose research focuses on juvenile justice, punishment, and policing of young people and inequality among juveniles. He is the author of Homeroom Security, School Discipline in an Age of Fear. Professor Kupchick, thank you so much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Tell me how extensive the police presence is in American high schools right now and why it is so omnipresent.
Well, what we've seen over the past 20 or so years is a big escalation. Now, it's hard to know exactly how much it's escalated. It's gone up by some estimates about 40%, the number of police officers, but different schools count security guards in their count, so it's hard to know precisely how many more are in schools. But we know that there's been a big jump over the past 20 years where more schools are using what they call school resource officers, who are, those are police officers. They're trained by the police department and they report to the police department, not a school, and they station them in schools full-time. The reasons why we're seeing them spread throughout the school are really unclear as well. I believe it has a lot to do with a generalized fear. People are really afraid of school crime and violence, despite the fact that schools have been getting safer for the past 20 years, or more than 20 years. They've been tracking general juvenile crime rates, and all sorts of victimization at school have become less prevalent over the past 20 years.
Is part of it, do you think, Aaron, because of the mass shootings at places like Columbine and more recently Newtown?
I think that that has fueled the fire, but I don't think that's the real cause because it was going on before then. It was definitely starting in the early 90s before Columbine, which is the largest of these incidents prior to Newtown.
And you've been documenting the number of arrests of students. Some of these offenses are offenses that happen every day in schools. They're young people, and they're not all that serious. Talking back to a police officer, doodling on a desk, even though you have an erasable marker, being an 8-year-old throwing a temper tantrum. Is it because these officers are trained more to find crime wherever they might look for crime rather than looking for serious possible felonies?
You know, it's I am critical of this movement, but it's really easy to be critical when we look at the numbers. And you're absolutely right in that description, that there are so many minor things. I mean, disorderly conduct, for example, which is usually just mouthing off to an adult, that tends to be the most common arrest in school. So you're right that these really minor things are what gets kids arrested. But, it's not just the police are looking for a crime. It's easy, when I said it's easy to be critical, I think that we forget how difficult it is to teach and how difficult it is to manage a school. Yeah, and it's very frustrating and very difficult on teachers, on school administrators, on security staff, and sometimes they resort to, what from the sidelines I think are overly harsh measures like arrest because they follow these kids through their lives. You mentioned an 8-year-old throwing a temper tantrum. Recently it was a 6-year-old throwing a temper tantrum in Georgia. was taken out in handcuffs. And in the, on the news that night, the head of the police force defended it as saying that's what we do for everyone we arrest, is we take them out in handcuffs.
What kinds of numbers are you looking at?
Of how many kids are getting arrested?
Yes.
We really don't have good national counts. This is, to me, one of the many, many disturbing parts about it, is that there's very little money to study this. There's a lot of money to put more police in schools, but very little money available to study this. And schools they tend to be reluctant to share data for obvious reasons. You know, it's very political. Some individual studies have looked at particular sites and found very different results. A couple studies have found that in some sites we don't see big increases. But then you have places like New York City, mm-hmm. where you see huge arrest rates. Though it's declined in the past couple of years, it has gone through major increases up to that. New York City has over 5,000 officers in their school safety division. That's managed by the police force, or that's part of the NYPD. That makes the school safety division of New York City's public schools, or NYPD, I think it's the fourth largest police force in the nation.
Oh, my goodness.
Just for schools.
And from what I've read about those arrests, 882 arrests last year, 95% were of Black or Latino students.
Yeah, that's one thing that we see across studies, no matter who's looked at this issue and how they've counted, is that Black and Latino youth are so much more likely to get wrapped up in school discipline and policing. This is true in the community, of course, as well, in terms of who gets arrested, and very prevalent in schools. If we're just talking about suspensions and who's more likely to get suspended, youth of color are far more at risk of suspension. Some studies have even tried to control for rates of misbehavior, so they take that out of the equation, compare just kids of similar backgrounds other than race, and kids who have do similar types of misconduct, and find that the Black youth and Latino youth are much more likely to get suspended and arrested.
You don't necessarily blame the police officers. You say, and this is true, that they're trained in street tactics that are not entirely appropriate in schools. They're not trained to know best how to deal with someone throwing a temper tantrum or someone doodling on a desk.
Exactly. You know, I've spent a lot of time studying how police officers work in schools and shadowing some really excellent people. I mean, every one of them that I met cares about kids and took the assignment because they wanted to help kids and wanted to be a mentor. I mean, these are great things, but they're not trained for the task. There's a lack of fit here. Exactly as you described it, they're trained in conflict. They're trained in how to end conflict with an arrest or some other means, right? They're trained in how to deal with threat and how to protect people. They're not trained in how to deal with a crying 15-year-old.
What is it that schools, because when you talk about one of the more common arrests maybe for mouthing off to a police officer or mouthing off to a teacher, heavens to Betsy, kids mouthing off to their parents and mouthing off to people in authority is something that has always been with us. What did we used to do about that?
Well, we didn't arrest them at school.
No.
We got sent to the principal's office if we misbehaved, or
right.
The teacher dealt with it. But what you see now is a split. You know, this was first noticed, and actually even earlier than the era I'm talking about, in the 1980s, by a scholar named Jim Devine, who looked at New York City public schools, and which was really leading this movement of putting police officers there. And what he argued was that when you put all these police officers in the school, you see a separation of function. So the teachers are more likely to say, you know what, okay, good. There's somebody I can rely on for security and discipline. So I don't have to deal with it anymore. I'm going to call the security guard. I'm going to call the cop. In a lot of schools where I've done my research, they have what are called deans of discipline. They didn't have those when I was in high school, in public high school, or middle school, or elementary school. But we have those at a lot of schools now. Or interventionists. And these are people, usually they're, again, well-intended adults, but they're coaches or, you know, a lot of them I met were former military people. People with they tend to be people with a pretty stern disposition or, you know, who kind of have that sort of attitude towards disciplining kids. And these are the people who now come get the kid and punish them. So the teachers have to deal with it in some ways less. Now, one result of this is that they have more disorder. They have more misbehavior to deal with. So they have to deal with it more in that way, but it gets farmed out to other people.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed any difference in police presence and number of arrests between city schools and suburban schools?
Well, that's a great question, too. That's another thing that we're just beginning to learn more about. And it's you know, the answer is somewhat complicated. There's been the assumption that in urban schools we see a lot more police officers, and particularly in schools with more youth of color and more poor youth. But it's not always clear exactly what that means and how true that is. A few studies, one that I helped conduct, another couple that other researchers have done, have tried to look at this. And what they found and what we found is that there are more police officers in schools with more youth of color, and certainly more urban schools, definitely more metal detectors. But you have a lot of other things, like, for example, drug-sniffing police dogs, which a majority of high schools use, but they're much more likely outside of cities. So, yes, there's more policing, and there seems to be more arresting done in the cities, but in other areas you see more other types of pretty harsh tactics mm-hmm. as well.
Aaron, what about, we hear, and it seems to be kind of anecdotal, but we hear that there are more students who are bringing weapons to high school. There are more fights going on in high schools where students can be hurt. There is more danger overall in schools in our country. Would you dispute that?
Absolutely, I would dispute that.
Really?
Certainly some schools, you know, anyone can say, well, I've been at this school for 30 years and I've seen this happen. And I'm sure there are schools like that. But when we look at national data, when we look at data collected across the country by the government, that includes teachers' reports, it includes students' reports of victimization, it includes counts by administrators, different ways of measuring, we see across-the-board decreases in violence, in fighting, in weapon carrying. Absolutely. These things have become much less common over the past 20-some-odd years.
Suspension rates more than doubled since the 1980s. That's quite an increase, isn't it?
It sure is. You know, one of the schools where I was embedded, where I spent a lot of time doing research, I calculated their suspension rate, which included kids who got suspended multiple times. They got counted multiple times in this rate because I couldn't figure out who was getting suspended. But it was I believe, 117 per 100 students. There were 117 suspensions given out for every 100 students in the school in that year.
Hmm.
It's in some schools, it's an extremely common method of basically handling all problems.
Mm-hmm.
And the most amazing part about it is it causes more problems in so many ways.
How so?
Well, when I've done my research, what I found repeatedly from almost every teacher I spoke to was when I asked them why kids act up, they told me usually it's because they don't understand what's going on in class. So they act like the class clown, or they try to get other types of attention. What happens? We kick them out. Now, I understand and totally sympathize with the teacher's frustration at trying to teach to 25 and one's making that difficult. But what we do is we just remove them from the school. We send them home for 3 days or more.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're not getting supervision. They're running around often on the streets with their friends who've also gotten in trouble, who tend to be, the ones more likely to get in trouble in the community. We're taking away supervision. We're taking away all instruction from them, from the kids who need it most. We're not doing anything to try to deal with the actual problem. There's no tutoring involved. There's no behavior management involved. And behavior management is punishment or consequences. But I saw in my research almost no link between punishments and actual solutions, asking kids what's going on at home or why are you acting up or how are you doing in your classes.
Right.
No link at all.
Senator Dick Durbin convened the first congressional hearings on the school-to-prison pipeline in December of last year. What is meant by a school-to-prison pipeline?
Well, the school-to-prison pipeline is it's a catchy phrase. It can be a little bit misleading at times, but it captures a very important and disturbing trend, and that is that the more kids that we suspend and arrest out of school, then they get records, they're more likely to drop out of school, they're less likely to get employed, they're at much greater risk of eventual incarceration. So, the school-to-prison pipeline is a metaphor that stands for this funneling of kids, ciphering off which kids are worthy of education, which kids we want to get rid of, and those kids are likely to wind up in prisons eventually. Obviously, it's not quite so streamlined. That's why I say it can be a little bit of an oversimplification. You know, the metaphor has its flaws, but it's helpful and a very disturbing trend.
We welcome phone calls for our guest. We're talking about the number of suspensions more than doubling since the 1980s, the very large police presence. We know a lot about New York City, but in suburban and urban classrooms all over the country, there is a very strong police presence, and the police are finding students to be, some of them are arrested or they're being suspended for making out, for blowing spitballs. There also is a great deal of testing. We have yet to talk about this, drug testing for an ever-expanding set of extracurricular activities. We'll talk about that as well. Aaron Kupchick has studied all of this in schools in the country. He's a professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Delaware. We welcome your phone calls. A lot of teachers have not yet returned to the classroom, or if you're in the classroom, maybe you have a chance to have the radio on before your students return. But I'm interested in hearing from people who are in school settings. Everybody, of course, we all were in school at some point, and it seems to me as though this is a marked change in the way discipline used to be handled. A number of questions come to mind. What is the best way to discipline students? If you're a teacher, do you feel better about having a police presence in the school? Should it be the job of an armed police presence to take care of discipline problems? If so, what should those problems be? And would you agree overall that we are thinking of our schools as these terribly dangerous places? Aaron would strongly dispute that, saying that's not the case. It's how we're dealing with discipline and students who are either being children or terribly misbehaving, depending on your perspective. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Later in the hour, we will be speaking with a member of a student-led group, Dream Defenders. A senior in high school from Miami will be joining us, and they're doing some very interesting work. They are now in their fourth week of a sit-in at the governor's office in Florida. They're concerned about stand your ground. They're concerned about racial profiling, and they're concerned about particularly Black and Latino students being singled out for misbehavior when there may not even have been any misbehavior. To your calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now. Aaron Kupchick is with us, the first part of the program, and let us start with Tim in Whitewater. Hi, Tim.
Good afternoon. I was a school teacher for 20 years. I taught both in the suburbs. I've taught in the inner city. I've been listening to what you have to say. I'm sorry that this kind of policing didn't start about 20 or 30 years ago, because that's when a lot of the problems were really starting to go on. I think what you see in schools is a sad comment on family life and society in general, because this is where all this kind of stuff originally comes from, because the students bring this nonsense to the classroom. The classroom is not a place where you can really have quality teaching and learning anymore. And I'm sorry that you have to bring the police in, but when the kids come in, their attention is not where it's supposed to be at. They're more concerned about their cell phones, whether they actually show them or not. They all look like slobs. Nobody dresses up. Everybody's in a leisure mode, and that's where their mind is, and they don't really care about learning anymore.
Tim, how would you as a classroom teacher handle disciplinary problems in your classroom, and what is the best practice, do you think?
My particular situation, I was fortunate the last 6 years of my teaching life, my teaching career, I should say, I did it in a private school, a boarding school type setting, where there was strict discipline. There was attire or a uniform that they had to wear. There was to poor behavior, there were answers, and there were punishments dealt out. and it worked to a great degree. It was not perfect by any means because of where the kids' minds are. But if I were in a situation, I would bring back, you know, the whole discipline thing, the whole thing as far as wearing a class attire,
a uniform, mm-hmm.
and all of that. But when you have what you have today, there's no surprise to me.
Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you like to respond?
Oh, sure. There are actually a number of things. I thank you for your comment, and I'm sorry you had that that experience. Let me start with the issue of private schools. Private schools are an entirely different game, entirely different situation. You can select your clientele. Only parents who can afford it or getting assistance can send their kids there. It adds a whole different element than public schools who take everyone. So it's, you know, private schools work quite differently in terms of discipline for a lot of reasons. And what works in a private school doesn't necessarily work in a public school. Secondly, as I said before, individual schools, certainly there's enormous variation in trends of what one school faces year after year and over 20 or 30 years compared to another. But nationally, we've seen more dress codes, not less. So we're really not facing a situation of going back to dress codes because we have more than we've ever had before. Similarly with misbehavior, we have less of it from students' perspective and teachers' perspectives nationally than we've had in a generation, not more. In terms of student engagement, the measures of that we have suggest that they're not the strongest measures because it's a hard thing to measure, but they actually suggest a direction very different than what Tim suggests across the country. Again, the individual schools he's working in or was working in, I've never been in those as far as I'm aware. And can't comment on them. But nationally speaking, a lot of these trends are going in the other direction.
All right. Thanks, Tim, very much for your call. Tony in Green Bay is next. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Good afternoon. I was listening to your guest this afternoon, and he was speaking about the increase of police presence in public schools, which I have seen. I grew up in public schools, and over the last 20 years, I've seen it. And then I've also heard him say that there's actually a decrease in the behavior, of the bad behavior of the children in those schools, and, you know, that there's less of a crime presence. But I didn't hear him mention how, you know, that there's a connection possibly between the police presence and the decrease in crime in the schools. Because obviously, you know, if a kid sees that there's consequences for a crime, they're going to stop it. My wife is also a teacher in public schools, and she believes that if there were more abilities put in her hands in the classroom, that she'd be able to discipline her kids better instead of having to send them to the authorities in the school.
What does she need that she doesn't have?
There's you know, with the changes in law for discipline in your school between corporal punishment when we were younger and, you know, the more liberal case as it is in classrooms.
You think we should be able to hit students?
No. I'm not. I was going to continue and
say
that we should have, not that I believe we should have corporal punishment in classrooms, but I think we have gone too far to the point where, you know, a teacher can control that one student who is disrupting the other 25 in the classroom without having to have him arrested and taken out of the school.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good point, because teachers do, and this is a very, very hard job, and I've heard many teachers say that problematic students can, of course, keep a classroom from moving ahead, and it's really hurtful to those who are engaged. What do you say to that, Aaron? After studying this, is there a best practice? Is there a way for...
Oh, sure.
What is it?
Well, there are so many things that we know, and I couldn't agree more with your wife on this. You know, we've taken, as I said before, we've kind of divorced teaching from discipline in some ways, not entirely, but we've taken a lot of the power and discretion out of the hands of teachers with negative consequences. In my research, for example, I met a number of teachers who were just fantastic at working with kids. And when there was a problem, they had a rapport with these kids, even the troublesome kids. And they would pull them out in the hall or do something and say, hey, what's going on? And there was a reason for the misbehavior. And they would deal with it quickly and get back to teaching. And it took a few minutes, but solved a lot of, or saved a lot of time, rather, long term.
Mm-hmm.
Those teachers never had disruptions in inner city schools with huge gang problems, okay? So, you know, when you have a school with teachers who do take it into their hands in positive ways, it can solve so many problems. You know, now that type of solution, that relies on a teacher's charisma and rapport with students, which isn't easy to build and develop. But there are so many good, you asked about what we should be doing. You know, there are a number of really well-evaluated programs, things like restorative justice. When kids do get into trouble, instead of kicking them out of school, you work harder to bring them into the school so that they understand what they did. You have them face the victim, whether it be, you know, if they damage school property, you can have them clean. You can have them understand why it's bad, why what they did is wrong. You get them involved in a process of trying to restore the harm that they made. There are other programs like positive behavioral interventions and supports where you reward kids for good behaviors, where you have an escalating series of sanctions that are not arresting them or suspending them just for talking back the first time, but we're slowly ramping up punishments and in positive ways. There are many evidence-based solutions. The problem is that across the country, we've been going completely the other way. There are certainly bright spots, but by and large, schools have been just excluding kids by kicking them out and arresting them when all the evidence says that that's really not an effective strategy.
Mm-hmm. Tony, thank you very much for your call. We have a lot of comments coming in on Facebook. Marcus has a lot to say. One thing he does say is this. These arrests may start the children down a road of getting a rap sheet and disenfranchising the individual. Would you agree with that, Aaron?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what we mean by the school-to-prison pipeline, that it starts them on this path with negative consequences for them, their families, their communities, for everyone involved. One more comment. I wanted to return to something, the first comment that Tony made, which was whether or not more police and discipline might be the reason for lower crime rates. And, of course, that's the $10 million question that so many people have asked. And all the research says no, that arresting more kids, being more punitive in schools, is not the reason for decreasing crime rates. In fact, if anything, some studies suggest that it might increase misbehavior, because instead of solving kids' problems, you're just making their problems worse. Right? Instead of actually dealing with why kids misbehave, you're kicking them out for a short period of time, or you're arresting them. And it doesn't send that message that, oh, look, you know, this school, you have to behave. It sends that message that, oh, they don't care about us here, and I don't really care about the school in return. So it can cause more problems than it solves.
We go to Ed in West Dallas. Hi, Ed.
We sort of had a dichotomy with a couple of callers ago between bad public education, good private education. And I have to tell you, just as a product of Catholic school education and the way in which many of us were brutalized, especially in the lower grades, in my situation, the first grade, where the nun had 69 students in one class, and the way she controlled discipline, she took the two of us who were the youngest in the class, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, one of us got the hell beat out of us. Tuesday, Thursday, the other one did. And then when you worked your chain through the higher grades, when you got to Catholic high school, you had the master of discipline, very well portrayed in a movie called Heaven Help Us, where you were constantly being brutalized for very minor stuff.
What do you mean brutalized? What was done to you?
You were being put on a paddle horse,
mm-hmm.
told to spread your legs, and you got whipped.
Mm.
And this is something that was standard operating procedure. Now, the Catholic schools don't exist in that same way anymore. But James Farrell wrote about this at the very beginning of Studs Lonergan. When Studs is thinking about graduating his eighth grade year, he's going back over his memory over all of the teachers he's had. And inevitably, you encountered these people in your Catholic schools.
Professor Kupchick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really sorry. That's really sad. We know that brutalizing kids, that just brings about no good. And And, you know, it's a shame that that happens or happened, and hopefully doesn't happen often anymore. You know, corporal punishment is, you know, especially on a scale like that, it just doesn't, you know, teaches kids wrong lessons. It's not an effective way to punish kids.
And yes, and yet we had it in many states for
still
a long,
do.
Long time.
So we still do.
Do we still have states? I didn't know that.
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. It's still legal in, I forget how many, but I believe around 20 states.
20 states?
I could be wrong. That's my,
wow.
Yeah, a while since I've looked at, but I think about 20 states.
Ooh. Thank you, Ed, very much for the call. It's horrible memories, really, of school, which is not as it should be. Chastity emails, behavior management is not just punishment and consequences in the negative connotation. It's also reinforcement, and reinforcement options should be exhausted first before turning to punishment procedures. It can be very effective when used correctly. Do you know how many behavior analysts are used in schools and how those schools function in comparison to those that use policing?
Mm-hmm. Great question. Yeah, I was speaking of one of those types of, there are many different behavior management programs, and they go by different names, and I mentioned one a little bit ago called Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports, and that's exactly the idea. And she's absolutely right that they do work. They work better than harsh consequences. I mean, don't get me wrong, certainly when kids do bad things, they need to be punished. No one's arguing that we shouldn't punish kids who do bad things and that we shouldn't punish them severely if they do severe things. But we jump too quickly, too fast to exclude them and arrest them. Now, how do schools do when they use these sorts of strategies? They tend to do a lot better, even in inner-city schools with a lot of trouble. You know, for example, the New York Civil Liberties Union published a report just a few years ago where they were able to do a program in a few schools which were called impact schools. That's a designation in New York City for schools that have real problems and crime problems. And they were able to reduce the police presence through an agreement with the city and implement one of these behavior management strategies. And attendance went up, school performance went up, behavior went down with a lower police presence, much lower police presence, lower security presence, and more behavior management.
Mm-hmm. Annie Thomas is going to join the conversation with you for a little while, Aaron. Annie is a senior in high school in Miami, Florida, and she's a member of an organization called Dream Defenders. They are students, high school students and college students, who have started a movement that is looking at a number of issues. It's looking at stand your ground laws. It's looking at racial profiling. It's looking at the school to prison pipeline that we talked about earlier. And they are black and brown students. They are now going into week four of a sit-in in the governor's office in Florida. They're demanding changes in Florida laws which criminalize young black and brown people. And we thank you, Annie Thomas, very much for joining us. Hello.
Hello. Hi. So I'm here.
I know you are. I know you are. Thank you so much for being with us. Tell me more about Dream Defenders. Were you organized as a result of the verdict in the Trayvon Martin, the George Zimmerman case, or have you been around before that?
So the Dream Defenders been around before that. The Dream Defenders actually originated after the killing of Trayvon Martin, after, because it took, I think, 45 days for George Zimmerman to be arrested, and the Dream Defenders was furious about that. So they stood up, they stepped up, and they actually shut down the police, like a police house and everything for the day, just to try to, you know, protest, to organize to get Zimmerman arrested.
Mm-hmm. You are demanding changes in Florida. You want changes in laws which criminalize young black and brown people. What kinds of laws are those, Annie?
All right, so we have this thing called Trayvon's Law, which has three components, which is the repeal of the Stand Your Ground Law, the addressing of the school-to-prison pipeline, and seeking solutions or alternatives as restorative justice. And the third one is targeting racism and racial profiling inside our society.
And you've been hearing, I understand you're having a sit-in in the governor's office. It's been going on for 4 weeks now, and people are coming to the office to give their testimony. Is that right?
Yes.
What are you hearing?
It's amazing how much people in this country have been criminalized and misjudged because of the color of their skin and been profiled inside our society. And that's basically what's being repetitive. Like, it's showing that we need this law to pass. We need to call this special session.
We've been spending most of this hour talking about what's going on inside schools and the use of police and the suspension or arrest of students for really misbehavior in many cases, the punishment much worse than what the crime is. Do you think that's a significant problem in Florida schools and the schools that you've attended? And do you think it's a particularly significant problem for black and brown students?
Of course it is. Generally, schools that are highly policed are located in areas that are highly policed. Generally, it's in black, brown communities or people working classes where they feel like they're constantly targeted and not only criminalized but harassed and feel like they grow up in a prison cell by just going to their schools.
Mm-hmm. Have you experienced any of that in your lifetime, Annie?
Yes, actually. I have. I lived in low-income areas most of my life. I'm from the working class. And going to school, we have 5, 6, 7 cop cars parked in front of our school every day where they follow us around the schools or they just misjudge us or randomly search us and everything because just of our skin color.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the best way? Everybody's struggling this hour, and we struggle as a society to figure out what it is we should do to make sure that all students can be educated. There are, of course, everybody knows, some students who may be disruptive. There are some students who may be dangerous in schools. What is that we ought to be doing as a society to make our schools really, really welcoming places, Annie, and safe places?
Well, for us, we're considering programs like restorative justice, which is policies and just practices that address and get to the root issue or causes of problems inside the school system. A lot of times when their students are acting out, majority of the time there is a root reason behind it. So restorative justice doesn't just hold the students accountable. It gets to that root cause, and it deals with everyone this problem affects. If two students fight, it doesn't only affect those two students. It might affect another student around them. It's just pretty much not only holding them accountable, but keeping them in the school system and allowing the root issues to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. You're doing a sit-in at the governor's office? Is that what's going on?
So we've been staying here for 24 days. Today's day 24.
Goodness.
And we're staying here, and we're going to keep staying here until we get our special session, and they call the special session on Trayvon's Law. Because we're serious about these issues and we're sick of the constant injustice and the criminalization of our youth of color.
Yeah.
And Dream Defenders doesn't only assist of high schoolers or college. It's everyone, all race, all backgrounds, all ages, all coming together on this issue.
I know you've had some pretty high-level support, too, from people like Harry Belafonte, who's visited you, right?
Yes.
We're going to continue our conversation with Aaron and also with Annie. They are both with us for the remainder of the hour. Annie Thomas, senior in high school in Miami, Dream Defenders, the name of the group that she is working with. They are an organized black and brown student movement, but as she said, open to all, they're occupying the Florida governor's office, and they are demanding changes in Florida laws which criminalize young black and brown people. Also still with us is Aaron Kupchick, professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Delaware. Here's our phone number. We welcome calls from you, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, Aaron Kupchick, professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Delaware. Annie Thomas is also with us, senior in high school in Miami, and with the movement that we've been talking about, Dream Defenders. Annie, with you is Aaron, and I wanted Aaron to respond to what you had to say. What students are doing, primarily students, is pretty remarkable, isn't it, Aaron?
Oh, I'm so impressed. I think it's fantastic. And thank you, Annie, for everything you're doing. And I couldn't agree more with everything she said, especially about getting to the root causes of problems and the over-policing of students who are already facing a lot of community problems and disadvantage to begin with. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it takes, I don't know what it takes in order for us to change things, but it's interesting as we look at the reality, Aaron. It is that there is an increased police presence and more suspensions and students appearing to be almost targeted if they're knowingly or unknowingly Black or Latino. We would be looking here at a completely different situation, a whole turnaround in the way things are, right, to the way they should be?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think that there are concrete and realizable steps we can take. I mean, the fact that we're having this program now, that Senator Durbin had his hearings in December, there is movement on this issue, and there's growing public awareness and concern where there wasn't just 2 years ago. There's a task force being created in my state. There have been a number in other states as well trying
really?
To reduce the school-to-prison pipeline. I'm a bit cynical about how much will change for the reasons you mentioned. I mean, I think there's so much ingrained, and it's so much of it seems to be about adults versus kids that it's hard to get that out and change people's attitudes broadly. But I do, I'm optimistic. On the other hand, that there are some changes we can take
mm-hmm.
where we spend less money and get better results. Everyone's interested in that, I think.
Annie, it would appear from what I've read about what's going on with Dream Defenders that you are making a difference. Do you think you're closer to a special session of the Florida legislature to look at all of the issues that we're aware of after the death of Trayvon Martin?
Well, definitely. I know we're getting closer because, as we stated many a time, the Dream Defenders are not going to leave, and we will continue to grow and stand our ground until we get that special session. And right now, I know there's another session that the House of Representatives has agreed to call on the Stand Your Ground law, but that's not our demand. Our demand is that all three of these issues be heard. And we're having small victories along the way, but we're going to keep going until these issues are addressed.
Yeah. Here's an email that's come in. In school, without my knowing, my son was issued a citation from the police, a $57 fine, because he admitted he had passed an inappropriate text from a friend's phone to his own. The school liaison officer figured that probably 800 people had seen him pass it on, but only 7 were cited. Not more, because they ended up with a drug case that week and didn't have time to search that case any longer. Because of the fine, I looked into and learned that a city municipal judge heard cases at the school on a regular basis and went to my son's hearing. Not a single parent I knew was aware this was going on in our high school. The hallway was filled with kids with cases ranging from this same text my son received, including the girl who initiated it, to kids fined for smoking in the bathroom, to a boy giving the finger to a teacher after school. The hallway outside the courtroom classroom was filled, but only 2 other parents were there. My son was not required to tell me, and had he not voluntarily, I never would have known. He was ticketed and fined without any proof, and this was taking place in Oshkosh.
Wow.
Well, unfortunately, that happens a lot because of the way the citations are set up now. Students are allowed to go and meet the hearings on their own without letting their parents know. But what that does is it targets students because if they found guilty and they have this fine, and then they can't pay the fine, next thing you know, the students have a warrant for their arrest, which goes back to the schoolhouse to jailhouse pipeline. And then it's like, the students are getting fined for any little thing, from throwing your eraser, from getting out their seats, to going to the bathroom. Things, you get simple citations out of anything, which all contributes to this process.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Deb in Mauston is next. Hi, Deb.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you, Deb?
I'm doing great. I have a comment. My husband and I, we raised 33, what they called treatment foster care. These kids had, you know, ADHD, ADD, OCD, you name it, and they had it. And one of the things that our school had done with these kids, because they had issues, they were predisposed to have these issues, was instead of kicking these boys out of school, because we only took boys, what they did, and they did it with all the students, not just mine, but what they did is they had an in-school suspension. And what they would do is they had one teacher or they would have the police officer sit in the room, and the kids were given their assignments from their classes that they were missing, and they were separated and sat in that room. And depending on how many days of suspension was how many days they sat in there. Because in my opinion, when you take a child who's being unruly in school and you kick them out of school for 3 days, all you're doing is giving them a vacation because they're going to do it just to get out of school. So to me, there should be more in-school suspensions. If you're going to have the police there, let the police put them in a room and monitor them there, but keep them in school. Do not kick them out and then make them do their assignments that they would have missed in the regular class period.
All right. What do you think of that, Annie?
Well, I agree, but I also disagree. I feel like when students are suspended from school, outdoor suspension, it's not necessarily always a vacation for students. Because generally, just missing 3 days of school, generally you have 6 classes a day. If you miss 1 week, you already have 40 Fs you have to make up. And it puts students and it makes them fall behind in their classwork. The idea of having the schoolwork and school suspension is great, but the problem with that is unless they have the teachers for those specific subjects in the room with them, it becomes harder for those students to do that work. And even if they have the work in front of them, they don't know the lesson, the background of that test, or whatever that's going on, and it causes them to fall behind even more, which is the reason we ask about restorative justice policies and stuff like that, where it allows, instead of you know, the issues being happening in the school or where they're pulling out the classroom at any cause, we're trying to primarily keep students inside the classroom mm-hmm. but still hold them accountable by giving them, like, maybe community service they have to do for a day or something else that makes them hold accountable and have a punishment but at the same time keeps them inside their learning environment.
Thank you, Jeb, for the call. Yes, Aaron.
Oh, I was going to say that that's exactly right. And also, what Deb describes is really almost a best-case scenario for in-school suspension. Most of the schools where I've observed in-school suspension, students aren't even allowed to do work. They're forced to sit there with their heads on their desks or just sit there quietly. They're not specifically forbidden. That's education now.
They're forbidden to do work. They're forbidden to go to their teachers and ask for the work.
Yep. So they're not allowed to even do that. Furthermore, I mean, if you were going to do in-school suspension, I agree, it's better than out-of-school suspension, the way she describes it, absolutely. But if you're going to do that, why can't we have someone trained in child development who can talk to these kids about what's going on and why they're acting up?
Well, the question is, why don't we? But we don't have time for that answer, I'm afraid. I do want to take this call concerning Stand Your Ground, because it's one of the things you're focusing on, Annie, and we're running short on time. Frank in Oshkosh, hi.
Yes, hi there. Annie, I was hoping you could explain how the Stand Your Ground law is inherently a racially based law, and maybe briefly explain the Stand Your Ground law and then go into how it is racially based.
All right, we just have a very short period of time, Annie.
Okay, I'm going to try to hurry up. So the Stand Your Ground law is sometimes racially based. It's not all the times. It can work. But the way it's set up is if you're on the street and you're black or you're a person of color, they're telling you pretty much the public space is a weapon to you. That concrete is a weapon. That you are constantly carrying a weapon and you are armed and dangerous by just walking outside publicly if you're dressed a certain way. Hmm. Which gives people the permission, the right, or the feel of being threatened or place fear in their heart, meaning that they have justified cause or reason to shoot or kill you.
We'll have to do a full show on Stand Your Ground. Aaron, we wondered if you have a website.
Well, I can be reached at www.udel.edu/soc, my department's webpage.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both so much for being with us. Annie, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron Kupchick, thank you so much for being with us this hour. Annie is part of the movement at the Florida governor's office. They are demanding changes in Florida laws criminalizing young black and brown people. Erin is a professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Denver. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning.